Our scripture, again, is taken from Genesis chapter 5, so please go ahead and open your Bibles back up to Genesis 5, and I'll actually read the entire chapter. So Genesis chapter 5, this is God's own word. This is the book of the generations of Adam. When God created man, he made him in the likeness of God. Male and female, he created them, and he blessed them and named them man when they were created. When Adam had lived 130 years, he fathered a son in his own likeness after his image and named him Seth. The days of Adam after he fathered Seth were 800 years, and he had other sons and daughters. Thus all the days that Adam had lived were 930 years, and he died. When Seth had lived 105 years, he fathered Enosh. Seth lived after he fathered Enosh 807 years, and had other sons and daughters. Thus all the days of Seth were 912 years, and he died. When Enosh had lived 90 years, he fathered Canaan. Enosh lived after he fathered Canaan 815 years, and had other sons and daughters. Thus all the days of Enosh were 905 years, and he died. When Canaan had lived 70 years, he fathered Mahalalel. Canaan lived after he fathered Mahalalel 840 years and had other sons and daughters. Thus all the days of Canaan were 910 years and he died. When Mahalalel had lived 65 years, he fathered Jared. Mahalalel lived after he fathered Jared 830 years and had other sons and daughters. Thus all the days of Mahalalel were 895 years and he died. When Jared had lived 162 years, he fathered Enoch. Jared lived after he fathered Enoch 800 years and had other sons and daughters. Thus all the days of Jared were 962 years, and he died. When Enoch had lived 65 years, he fathered Methuselah. Enoch walked with God after he fathered Methuselah 300 years and had other sons and daughters. Thus all the days of Enoch were 365 years, Enoch walked with God, and he was not, for God took him. When Methuselah had lived 187 years, he fathered Lamech. Methuselah had lived after he fathered Lamech 782 years, and he had other sons and daughters. Thus all the days of Methuselah were 969 years, and he died. When Lamech had lived 182 years, he fathered a son and called his name Noah, saying, out of the ground that the Lord has cursed, this one shall bring us relief from our work and from the painful toil of our hands. Lamech lived after he fathered Noah 595 years and had other sons and daughters. Thus all the days of Lamech were 777 years, and he died. Verse 32, after Noah was 500 years old, Noah fathered Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Amen. May God bless the reading and hearing of this portion of his word. This genealogy here in Genesis chapter 5 is here for very important reasons, obviously. First, it's a contrast between the genealogy that we see with Cain in Genesis chapter 4. In Cain's genealogy, we see his descendants, and we see the human race kind of looking as if it's propelling and advancing and doing great things. Cain's descendants are credited with innovations and technologies that we use even today, agriculture, farming, metalwork, even music. And so we see that in Cain's genealogy and with his descendants. But what we really see is that while man looks as if he's advancing, what's actually happening is that man is declining. Cain's descendants can also be credited with the spread and practice of polygamy. We read in Genesis chapter 4, verse 19, about Cain's great-great-great-grandson, Lamech. This is another Lamech. We read that he took two wives. And this same Lamech, in verse 23, he kills a young man, and then he brags about it. So we get a very different theme from Genesis 4's genealogy with Cain than we do here in Genesis 5 with Seth's genealogy. Before chapter 5 even begins, again, back in chapter 4, we get a hint that there's a difference between these two lines, the line of Cain and the line of Seth. Chapter 4 ends by telling us that Adam and Eve gave birth to a son who would replace Abel after he was murdered by Cain, and that this son, Seth, at the time of his son's birth, Enosh, men began to call upon the name of the Lord again. So Cain's line in genealogy, through it we see the progression of the seed of the serpent. And with the line of Seth here in Genesis chapter 5, we trace the promised line of the seed of the woman. So that's the first thing. The second thing that this genealogy does is that it's a bridge between the pre-diluvian and the post-diluvian age. And what does that mean? That's simply talking about the age before the flood and the age after the flood. It's our bridge. The waters of Genesis, no pun intended, can flow and make sense because of Genesis chapter 5. So those are pretty much the two things or the main themes. How do we get from Adam to Noah and make sense of it? Genesis chapter 5. So understanding those two things, which I believe are the main points that this chapter is kind of given us, there are other details here that are very important in their own way and that we're going to look at and use. They're significant here, and they can show us, I believe, the sad reality that we sometimes forget while also offering us hope. So we'll look at that. We'll look at those by looking at five things that we see here in this genealogy. And we'll start with our first thing. We actually see this as we read verse 1. And it says, "This is the book of the generations of Adam. When God created man, he made him in the likeness of God." So the first thing, if you're taking notes, number one, we see here the reminder that man was made in the image of God. The reminder that man was made in the image of God. And we see the pattern that's given to us here in Genesis chapter 5. There's an individual who is named, followed by their age at the time of the birth of a particular son, the number of years that the individual lived after the birth, and then the total number of his years put all together. And then it repeats, father, son, so on and so forth. So beginning with Adam, we know Moses wrote this. He wrote Genesis. Why didn't Moses just begin with verse 3 after he stated what he said in the first sentence of Genesis chapter 5? Sort of like this. Why didn't he just write, "This is the book of the generations of Adam. When Adam had lived 130 years, he fathered Seth." Why not that? And here's the reason why. Because if that was the case, the genealogy here would be incomplete. Yeah, Adam was the first man created. So that means that there were no other humans on the earth to give birth to Adam. But let's be clear on one thing. Adam had a father. Moses, he knew good and well who Adam's father was. And so that's the very reason why chapter 5 begins the way that it begins. This is the book of the generations of Adam. When God created man, he made him in the likeness of God. You see what Moses is doing? Adam fathered Seth. Seth fathered Enosh, but it was God who fathered Adam. This is intentional. It's very intentional. And the intention here is to take us back to Genesis chapter 1, verse 26. And to remind us that man was made in the image of God, in the likeness of God. A very important reminder. But now here's my question. How would you define the Imago Dei, the image of God? When we talk about Adam being created in the image of God, in what way would we say that Adam was like God? What does it mean that Adam was made in the image of God? Here's what it doesn't mean. We know that it doesn't mean that Adam looked like God, right? Because we know that God, he's not a physical being. He doesn't have hands. He doesn't have eyes. He's invisible. He's immaterial. He's spirit. Okay, so then maybe a lot of people, they believe that this means that God's image in Adam can be seen or has to do with Adam's spirit or his soul, the inner part of Adam. But see, we can't do that either. We cannot talk about man in a way that separates his body from his soul or vice versa. Because a body and a soul united is what it means to be man. It's how God created his son Adam as a whole being, body and soul. So the image of God, it doesn't refer to Adam looking like God physically or how Adam looked. It doesn't refer to his inner being, excluding his physical body. It's not even about Adam's intelligence. There are plenty of animals who display a certain kind of intelligence. Here's a basic definition of the image of God. Okay. God's image in Adam refers to the fact that Adam was created in true righteousness and holiness with a sense or knowledge of a responsibility and obligation to obey God's command or his law. At its heart, what it means to be an image bearer of God, it has nothing to do with the inner part of Adam or us, as if we possess a little bit of divinity in our inner being or in our souls. At the heart, the image of God is really covenantal, okay? The one thing, if we're honest, that really separates us or man from being on the same level as the rest of God's creation, it's not the mere fact that we're humans, that we're man, okay? I want you to understand what I'm saying. I'm not saying that we are not different from other animals. Man, we're very different from animals and the other creatures and all of God's creation. But we're not special compared to these other creatures because we walk upright or talk or we can build things. That's a very subtle yet man-centered way of kind of robbing God of his glory, right? Making us important just because of who we are. See, what makes man special is the fact that God acted freely to choose to enter into a covenant relationship with human beings instead of any other creature. That's it. If God wanted to choose a frog, he could have chosen frogs. He could have entered into covenant with dolphins. Could have chosen tigers. He chose man. His choosing of man is this. In his choosing to have this special relationship with man, we're talking about a covenant relationship. What God was doing was imparting Adam, and that means us as well, with responsibilities. And we're not just talking about working and procreating. Again, even the animals and other creatures are commanded to do that. When God says, let us make man in our image, this is what he's doing. This is the image of God. He's crowning Adam with the responsibility of loving God enough to serve him perfectly. And he does that. He serves God perfectly by loving all of the rest of God's creation and leading them into a destiny of glorification. That's God's image in Adam. That's what it means when we say that Adam was the son of God. Adam was righteous and holy enough to love both God and others in a way that would have pleased God so much that God would have said, come, take a seat, my son. Sit here in this throne. Job well done. So that's what we mean essentially when we talk about the image of God. That's the most basic definition that we can give. The most basic sense is that Adam was created in the likeness of God and that he was created to reflect God's righteousness and holiness and was created to do so in perfect communion with the rest of God's creation. Okay? Now, the reason that I guess we might feel burdened, if any of us do, by the idea of being image bearers of God right now at this point, hopefully it's because of how things turned out with Adam. And we know how things turned out. After Adam's fall, the image of God has become almost unrecognizable in all of us. We no longer possess the same righteousness and holiness that Adam had when God created him for us to be what God made us to be. And I think that's one of the reasons, brothers and sisters, that Moses, inspired by God the Spirit, makes sure to remind us that even though man has become increasingly wicked in this earth, even now, with all of the terror and the horror that we see everywhere, even now, brothers and sisters, we are image bearers of God. God has not revoked the title of man as his image bearer. We're all image bearers of God. But here's the thing. I think now we know better and we have a better understanding that that doesn't really give us all the more reason to boast. Not in the condition that we're in. To hear that we're image bearers of God, it's actually all the more reason for us to cry out to God for his mercy. And here's why. When was the last time that any of us stood and offered God a perfect reflection of himself? See, verse 1 reminds us that Adam was created in the perfect image of God. But verse 3, it hits us with our hard reality. Here's what verse 3 says. When Adam had lived 130 years, he fathered a son in his own likeness, after his image, and named him Seth. See, here's the second thing. Although Adam was created in the image of God, man is born in the image of man. And that's talking about you and me. Sin, it's in us. Even while we retain the blessing of being God's image bearers, we have to remember that we are sinners. There's a double image thing going on right now with us. Here's Adam and Eve. Once again, they're having another son, birthing their third son, we suspect. And this son is going to replace Abel. There's some promise here. You hear Eve crying out again. She's rejoicing. She has some more hope and joy because here we go, another seed. This may be the promised son, the promised seed. The first son, he was a murderer. The second son, he had so much promise, but he died. The third time is a charm. Here's our third son, Abel. And while there is reason to find hope in the birth of Seth, the problem is, and that's because Seth would be the line, as we said, that the true promised seed will come through. Poor Seth, he came into this world filled with sin. He himself filled with sin. I kind of hesitated to give this illustration, so I kind of turned it. My mom, she said that for the first week of me, after me being born, I was an ugly baby. I didn't want to talk about ugly babies, so I'll use myself. It was just for a week. But that didn't stop her from taking pictures. Plenty of pictures within the first week. She dressed me, put on all the cute outfits. She clung to me. I was her son. It was that title, and it was that relationship as her son that gave me any hope of any kind of pride when it came to being me. But the reality, according to her, seemed to be that for 1 week, I was ugly. Double image going on here. Verse 3 teaches us that we're sinners by nature. And that means that for us, the race is over before it even begins. Doesn't matter how long you've been at it. It could be 50 years plus. You haven't gotten any better than you have when you first started, when you first came into this world. Now, you couple that with the fact that we have an obligation given to us by God to be as he is in all that we do. And brothers and sisters, we're not left boasting if we have any sense. Our blessing as image bearers really has become our curse. Now, here's the thing. Some people, they're deceived into thinking. We talk about the two lines, the line of the seed of the serpent and the line of the seed of the woman. Some people are deceived into thinking that when we talk about the righteous line of Seth versus Cain's wicked line, that Seth's line is to be commended for their own efforts, and they're working their way back to God and to earn his grace and his acceptance. And it's almost as if these men are considered righteous simply because they're born into the right family. But you got to notice something here. With the exception of three men, Adam, Enoch, and Lamech, the only information that we're really given about these men are the years of their lives and the fact that they fathered children. So two things here. First, in the same way that Cain's line is made up of sinners who descended from Adam, so does Seth's line. These men, including Enoch, and we'll talk about Enoch, walked with God, Enoch, They're not listed here because they're better than Cain's descendants, morally. We don't know how many people Jared may have stolen from. We don't know how many people or how many wives Methuselah or even Adam took. We don't know. Seth could have been just as lustful as King David. We're not given any details on the quality of these men's lives. So these guys are not here because of their lack of sin. That's the first thing we're trying to say. It's not about us walking with God like Enoch. And again, we'll look at that a little later. But a second thing, neither could any of these men find comfort from the judgment that was to come because they were born into this line. Right? They're not in this line because they're righteous in and of themselves. And they're not okay. And they don't escape God's judgment just because they're born into the right family. In other words, while sinners give birth to sinners, here's what we see. Saints don't give birth to saints. That's the point. And we have good reason to believe that Adam, I believe that Adam was a saint saved by God's grace because of the faith that he placed in the promised seed that was to come, the skull-crushing seed. And you see this in several places. Number one, he taught his sons to worship God with a blood sacrifice. You also see his confession when he names Eve the mother of all living, even though it was her who helped bring death into the world. You see Adam's hope there. Same thing with Enoch or Enosh, whose birth somehow began or started an increase of men calling on the name of God and worshiping God. Enoch, of course, and Noah, I'm sure we will believe that they're saved because Hebrews gives us insight into this. And the writer of Hebrews tells us this. The point that I'm making is that it would only take one, and we'd have a domino effect of saints being born, one after the other. But that's not what happens. Sinners run down the line of Seth. And you think about this. There's nobody born today who can trace themselves back to the line of Cain because his line was cut off during the flood. And so what that means, in fact, everyone, including us, everyone here and everyone born after the flood, we're all descendants, actually, of Seth through Noah and his sons. But nobody goes to heaven because of that fact, right? All of us who descend from Seth, there's one of two realities for us. We're either going to heaven or we're going to hell. Saints don't birth saints. Sinners birth sinners, and even saints birth sinners. There's a reality TV show. It's called Preacher's Daughters. And it was given, doesn't seem like too many people heard of it. It's been given 3 seasons. And you know what a show needs, just to get past 1 season nowadays, a reality TV show, all it needs is drama, right? So you couldn't imagine a show being called Preacher's Daughters would have any kind of drama. But that could be, that's the furthest thing from the truth. I've never really watched an episode. I just saw the trailer, but I saw enough. And it showed me that Christians, they don't birth Christians, right? Being born and raised religious, that's my story. That's some of your story. That was these girls' story. But you see that they end up not wanting to have anything to do with the God of their father. And I'm not saying that because of their behavior, but because of what some of them confess on a show. So the reality is this. There's a double image that man possesses. Both of them we get from Adam, the image of God, yet the image of Adam, the image of man, which is a fallen image. We're created in the image of God, but all men are born sinners like Adam. So this takes us to the third thing. And quickly, we want to look at a few explanations for the long lifespans of the patriarchs. And I promise this is connected some kind of way, right? So the first thing, there's a reminder that man is made in the image of God. Secondly, although man is made in the image of God, we're born in the image of man. Third thing, really quick, is an explanation for the long lifespans of the patriarchs that we see here. And this is what most people get excited about when they read this chapter. But this is really just a minor detail that, if I'm honest, it has little importance on really those main two points that I brought up earlier. But we'll look at it. And a lot of people, they use this, they use the numbers here to try to calculate how old the earth is. I won't be doing any of that. And to be honest, I would warn against it for a lot of reasons. But I really just want to take a quick look at three explanations. We could really call them speculations, two of them. Only the third one, I would say, is an explanation of fact. The other ones is just us assuming and speculating. So as it pertains to the long lifespans of these patriarchs, first explanation is the scientific or biological explanation. And this one I'll be giving the least amount of time to because I'm not a biologist, nor am I one who was there and present to witness any of this. So it's just speculation. Some people would say or give a scientific or biological explanation for the long lifespans that we see here by stating or looking at the types of diet maybe that the patriarchs were on, by looking at the manual labor that they did day after day. Maybe those things played a part in their health, and that's what sustained them and kept them alive for so long. Some also speculate about the quality of the air, not really any pollution. And then there's also the canopy theory. The canopy theory says that the Earth's atmosphere was different before the flood than it was after the flood, and that's for several reasons. But they say that the atmosphere actually had a layer of liquid or some type of water that intercepted all of the cancer and life-shortening rays. So that's the biological or scientific explanation, right? Just speculation. Secondly, there's the practical explanation. Whereas the biological explanation kind of seeks to answer how did man live so long? The practical explanation is us saying, okay, why? What was accomplished by these long lifespans? And again, this is speculation. This, I think, is good speculation. John Gill, a Baptist preacher and Bible scholar from the late 17th, early 18th century, he gave four points that I think are very interesting and intriguing as to why man lived so long. And here's the four things that he said. Number one, it's for the multiplication of mankind. All right, you wonder how we go from two people to billions. Well, you give them enough time and you can get a lot of people, right? That 19 kids and counting. I don't think they're 50 years old and already 20 kids. So you take that and you multiply that by years, you're going to get enough kids. And it wasn't a lot to do back then, all right? So that's the first thing. Secondly, he says, for the cultivation of arts and sciences, right? How would man develop art and science and fine-tune it, have enough time to fine-tune it enough so that it was worth anything? Well, you give them a long lifespan. You think about Steve Jobs, the person who created or innovated all of Apple's technology. In just, I want to say 10 years, 15 years, we've gone from brick phones to phones that can, you can talk to somebody face to face. And that all took place in a matter of 10 years. Steve Jobs lived with 50 or so years. Imagine if he had 800, 900 years, what he could do. So you have man created, and God expects man to go and cultivate the earth, and long life is a helper in that sense. Thirdly, Gill says, it was also for the spread of true religion in the world. This is interesting as well. A lot of times, those who would refute Christianity or the Bible, they would say, hey, you know, there's a lot of what you have there, we hear about it here. There's a flood story from ancient Mesopotamia and from the Chinese, they have a flood story. If we look at what's said here, well, maybe the fact that men live so long, and you think about this, Adam, out of everybody in this list, Adam met every single one of them or was alive to meet every single one of them except for Noah, if the record's true. So how would Seth or Mahalalel or Methuselah, Lamech, know about what took place in the garden, or everybody on the earth at that time? They wouldn't have to listen to secondary source. Adam was there to tell them, God created me. I fell, here we are. Yeah, Noah, who of course carried on this information, he would have heard it from just one person, down from Adam. Seth was alive during the time of Noah, before Noah before he died, he would have had an opportunity to meet Noah and pass the same information down. So practical reasons as to why men live so long. The multiplication of mankind, cultivation of the arts and sciences, spread of true religion, and a handing down of important things. Again, speculation doesn't affect the heart of what we're looking at here. But the third thing I think is important, and it's the theological explanation. And it's all that matters. Why did man live so long? We get intrigued by it, but it's simply because God numbers man's days. It's God who gives life and God who takes it, and he sprinkles out his grace early and gives man as many years as he sees fit for whatever reasons that he sees. Now, I use that to make way and make sense of our fourth point. And the fourth point is this, or the fourth thing that we want to look at from this genealogy, and this should be obvious, it's the reign of death. The reign and the rule and a prevalence of death. Now, there's a lot of irony in the way that we might read about the lives and the death of Seth's line. Again, we're intrigued and we're amazed by the long lifespans that we see these men living. But we're so casual when we read about their deaths, as if that's what's supposed to happen to them. We get hyped up and excited to see these people live so long, but we pass through them and we say, oh, and they died, without blinking an eye. The mood of this chapter 5, and this genealogy, really, it's cold and it's tragic and it's sad from the start. We're reminded that man was originally created perfect. He had everything, and there wasn't one thing that man needed, and there wasn't one thing that he had to worry about. But early on, we read that man messes that up, a sad tune. And then we read that man is graciously, he's gifted with physical life, long years, children. But then reality kicks in. That even though we got to walk out of Eden and build cities and marry and have families, celebrate birthdays, celebrate anniversaries, live long and prosperous lives, we didn't get away with what we did in Eden. 900 years later, we think maybe God has forgotten, right? Maybe I got away with it. Maybe he's let it go. 900 and some odd years later, God makes good on his promise, and Adam drops dead. And God has visited everybody since, and he will visit everybody else who's lived ever since Adam, who have in the same way disregarded God's command in favor of their own desires. That's our reality. A sad note. When we look at this ancient family tree here, We're not supposed to get caught up in the long lives and in the fact that some of our ancestors almost made it to 1,000 years and then overlooked the fact that no matter how long they lived, no matter how many years God gave them, eventually he took his breath back. Even in life, one of our biggest problems is that we become oblivious to the fact that there's a problem with our existence, right? We see it as we look here, and we see it in real life. So we start making plans here on earth, not for something better, but we plan. We spend our days and our weeks and the high points of our moments planning for things that in reality, it's us just settling. There's a broken world that we live in, and it's filled with problems, and it's filled with toil, and it's filled with turmoil. And the brokenness of this world, you know what? Sometimes it really doesn't affect us. We really don't have a problem with it. If we could live a million years here in this wasteland, some of us would. Every month, I start a new workout routine, or I start a new diet. And I even had my wife buy some vitamins that I think I needed. And everywhere you look, there's this rage about health. It doesn't stop every year. And health is important. But here's the problem. When I'm really on a roll, sometimes even me, I forget. My hope starts to get caught up in how many years have I added to my life? I'm doing so good, the weight's dropping, more energy. Man, I wonder how many years have I added to my life? Brothers and sisters, if my hope and my joy is in an extra year on this earth, I'm settling. I've become blind to my true reality. And that's the whole point. The longest life and the wealthiest life that you can have here is absolute poverty compared to just 1 minute in the world before there was sin and before the fall. But even more importantly, and glory to a gracious God, 1 second in the world and the presence of God in the world that is to come. Adam lived 930 years, and he spent a great amount of that time, I believe, not hoping for more years. Genesis tells us, in Genesis 6, it tells us that by the time Noah was alive, wickedness was all over the world in a way that was, we can't even imagine. And so Noah lived through this, and Adam, he died again, just maybe 100 or so years before Noah. Adam had to spend every day with the guilt of what he had done. He saw it. He looked outside of his home. He saw everything, and he knew that it was because of him that this was so. And it's interesting. Adam was the first person to sin, or sin is counted to. He's not the first person to die. He sees his sons die, and I'm sure he saw many other people die. But eventually, he died. And even in those other deaths, Adam knew where his hope was. His hope wasn't in this reality. So for the genealogy that we're looking at here, here's what's happening. It's singing to us a very depressing song. This genealogy here in Genesis chapter 5, it's singing a depressing song of our fall. And that's the way that we need to read it. It's not until verses 24 and 29 that we get any hope that's recorded here. So here's the thing. If God sparing 800 and 900 years of a man's life wasn't the high point of this chapter, then what is? What is it that's supposed to get us excited when we look through this? Likewise, if our ultimate hope shouldn't be in our health, it shouldn't be in our bank accounts and our wealth or the success of our children or the stability of our good careers, what is it that should drive us and drive our lives to live another day in this world? What should motivate me while I'm here working and living? Well, in closing, we find it in our fifth point, and that's the hope of Lamech. Man is created in the image of God, but we're born in the image of Adam. God has graciously given man long lives, long and prosperous lives. But there's still death. Even for the longest creature living, there's still death. Where is our hope to be found? It's the same place that Lamech's hope is found. And here's how I believe God showered Adam and any other saint that we have listed here in a time when the world was evil. It saw evil every day in the same way that we do. Here's how I believe God showered them with his grace and with hope. As Adam and everyone else lived in the midst of a perverse, filled world, God gave them the joyful reminder that he would give them rest. That's what he did. We first see this in verse 24, and we see it with Enoch. And I'm not going to get into the whole Enoch walking with God thing, not just for the sake of time, but we really don't have to. See, here's all we need to know about Enoch. Enoch was one of God's reminders to his people that he had a place prepared for them and that he would rescue them from this world. Verse 24 says that Enoch walked with God and he was taken. We'll actually read it. Verse 24 says, we'll start in verse 23. Thus all the days of Enoch were 365 years. Enoch walked with God and he was not, for God took him. Now, Hebrews, again, it sheds light on what it means or what it meant that Enoch walked with God. And it makes it very clear that we're not talking about Enoch's deeds here. We're not talking about what Enoch did, his quality of life. Enoch was taken because he was given faith to believe that God was and that God is and that God is to come. That's what we're told Enoch preached. Enoch was given the gift of faith to see God for who he is. He's creator, but he's also judge, and he's redeemer. And God took Enoch because Enoch was made righteous by the seed of that woman who was promised to him, the seed that Adam and all of them knew about. The same way that Adam and the other Old Testament saints were saved. So Enoch, his salvation from this world, I believe, was a means of grace that God used to strengthen his people's faith. And as Adam would hear about Enoch being translated, or would have seen Enoch being translated from this world, I'm sure that that's what kept Adam going. I'm sure that that's what gave him hope amidst his reality, that sin was here and it was because of him. But secondly, we see that God also continued to constantly remind his people that there was a son coming who would give them rest from this curse. Verse 29 is a clear display of what God's people placed their hope in, even then. In verse 29, we read about Lamech. He's the father of Noah. And I'll actually start with verse 28. When Lamech had lived 182 years, he fathered a son and called his name Noah, saying, "Out of the ground that the Lord has cursed, this one shall bring us relief from our work and from the painful toil of our hands." Brothers and sisters, church, Lamech drives home what I pray I've communicated, or at least tried to communicate this evening, that our image bearing, it sucks. We don't bear the image of God perfectly, and we do a way better job of bearing the image of fallen Adam than we do. And on our best day on this earth, in our most enjoyable moment that we can ever experience here, our soul should be simultaneous. While we're enjoying the things that we enjoy, our soul should at the same time be crying out to God, hoping for a better day, the day of final rest. When Lamech says that Noah, this one, is going to bring us relief from the toils of our hands, from the curse of the ground and from the pain of our hands and from our work, Lamech isn't talking about Noah being a second set of hands to help him with the farming. That's not what he means. A lot of, in the synagogue, you'll hear that. But this is what Lamech is trying to say. He's summing up all of the curses that was appointed to Adam by God when he says that this one will bring us relief from our pains and from the toils of this work. He's summing up everything that God cursed Adam with in Genesis chapter 3. So even as Christians who received complete rest in Jesus, right, we have rest. We found it in the true promised seed. Brothers and sisters, we're still hoping for another day, right? I hope we are. The day when he'll come again and he will give us our final rest, because here's the reality. We're saved already, but not yet. The ground is still cursed. The world is still wicked, and our hands still hurt. So we're waiting on that seed. That's where we place our hope. That's where we place our hope. And it's interesting, as we close, if you look, summed up in just three persons in this genealogy, if you take three of them, Adam, Enoch, and Noah, summed up here is actually God's story of redemption. See, in Adam, we have the fall from that perfect image. In Enoch, we have our salvation from the curse and from this world. And in Noah, we have the final judgment. We have consummation and new creation. Brothers and sisters, I pray that as we looked and we got a glimpse into the Old Testament world, we see that even then God supplied his people through the same means of his promise of a seed. And I pray that our hope is placed in there again on this day, as we've been filled from morning to evening. To God be the glory. Amen. Let us pray.